The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Welcome, listeners. Welcome to Hearth Tales on Fresh FM. Join me, Rich McCoy, as we gather closer to hear the tales of seasoned artists, makers, creative souls, and those who love to support them. Listen to stories of their journeys, how they wrestle with their demons, and how they balance their calling with the scaffolding of admin, life, and self-promotion. In the studio, we have Daryl Frost from Frost and Fire. It's a real privilege to have you with us.
Thank you.
To kick things off, would you mind introducing yourself and telling us a bit about what you do?
Okay, I'm Daryl Frost, and I've got the studio on Harley Road, where I sell lots of other people's work, but I also have my own studio. It's just a small 360 square meter studio, so just a little one. where I make a lot of sculpture, a lot of work out of clay recently, but I work in other mediums when I want to.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Yeah, I've had the privilege of having a wee walk around once, and it's quite a space.
It's quite a space. Shed envy.
Yeah. So you've had a truly impressive career with ceramics since about the late 1980s, is that right?
Yeah. Was in hospital when I was quite young and played with clay, and then when I was like 14, I rode my motorbike from Lee, which is north of Auckland, all the way down to Auckland with all my mates, and we went to a potter's house for lunch, and my mate's dad, and I remember walking through his studio at that young age and just going, wow, This is somewhere where I could live and work. And then, of course, you just carried on in life. I did my building apprenticeship, and while I was doing my building apprenticeship, I did night class pottery. And then I just wanted to see how the other half lived, so I gave up being a builder and built a house truck and ended up in Nelson a few years later and was supposed to be here for 6 weeks and never left.
Wow. That's quite a journey. And so your work is really connected to, is it Anagama? Is
that Anagama, which is a tunnel kiln, giant tunnel kiln. It sort of looks like a cucumber going up a hill. There's no bag walls. There's nothing to, apart from the pots, in there. And it's just, to me, one of the most scariest, riskiest, but most fascinating ways to fire pottery.
Yeah, it's quite a spectacle. You got flames coming up the top and out the sides and all that kind of...
Well, a lot of it that you see is performance art, almost, to it. Because sometimes it is like that during a firing, but it's not a lot all the time.
Right.
So that's sort of what you see, is sort of the highlight little bits of how we fire. But, you know, a lot of it's just sitting there and watching, listening to the kiln, looking at the pots, looking at everything in there, and just trying to work out what you need to do to control it.
And what was it that drew you to that technique?
When I was studying, because I did a few years study at Nelson Polytech back in the craft design days, I was working with amazing potters like John Crawford and Christine Boswick and John Crawford, and then on the other hand I was working with, you know, like Ross Richards, Chester Neely, Richard Parker from up Kaio. They were all wood firers.
Right.
And these guys were all domestic firers. And I learned a lot from both of them. Mm-hmm. But my calling was the more looseness, the more intriguing, the more challenging sort of style.
Wonderful. And you recently did, how long ago was it you did your 100th firing?
I did my 100th firing a couple of years ago.
Right.
And that was quite hard to work out. Someone asked me how many firings I'd done in an interview, and I went, I don't know. So I then started going back and calculating and going, well, I was at that firing, but I didn't really participate, so I can't add that one. So, you know, I only wanted firings that I was majorly involved with.
Right.
And yeah, I've cracked over 100 now.
Wow. And that correlated with an exhibition at the Centre and stuff.
Yeah. It was a great show. That took about 3 years from the concept idea of going to the you know, the suitor and saying, hey, I want to do another show, and, you know, then going, well, what's it going to be called, blah, 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 and then what work are you going to make? And it's going to, well, because I only farm a big kiln one, two times a year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we did do three just before my exhibition, but, you know, that's a lot of work.
That's, yeah, it's impressive. And what does it mean to you to have done that many?
It's just my life.
Yeah.
It's just what I do, you know. It's how I live and how I make a living nowadays, you know.
And so beyond the sort of the aesthetic outcomes, what are the, like, the real technical challenges and demanding aspects of that consistency of doing those sort of things?
Probably 80% of a firing is the way you load it.
Mm.
You've still got to make the work with the right type of clays, and I make all my own clays and slips and stuff as well. And then it's where in the kiln you put them, how you put them, what angle, what clay goes at the front, what clay goes at the back, what size fits here, what. And you're trying to think like a river of water or flame flowing through these pots. So you want some protected, you want some really abused, you want some thicker ones for where you're going to side stoke and actually literally throwing wood on top of the pots. So yeah, it's the process of making them in the series, and then the loading, and then the firing is just that process of getting it hot enough and stirring it and getting the ashes and manipulating the flame to where you want it to go and things like that. And then right at the end, you have to decide how you're going to close it down and stop the fire. So you can do that and make it all go black. You can make it all go shiny.
Mm.
You can make it some black, some shiny, some dull. Yeah, at the end of 5 days of complete exhaustion, you have to make a couple of more critical decisions.
So is it 5 days for the complete firing?
Yeah.
To cool down?
For a big anagama firing, it's 5 days, 24 hours a day.
Wow.
You're throwing in wood every 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes for the last couple of days.
So you've got to physically have somebody there to...
Oh, yeah. Right, wow. From the beginning, it's 24 hours a day. Someone is there.
And I noticed you put flowers on the top. Is that for the kiln gods type thing?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's I got shown that by Darryl Robinson, another wood firer of the time. And it's just a tradition I've carried on.
Yeah.
And I'm too scared now to not do one without flowers.
Yeah.
And I've changed those rules to being flowers off my property.
Beautiful. Now,
you know? Which sometimes is quite difficult to find, but it's just that whole process of going, right, we're doing a firing now, this is my life for the next 4 or 5 days, is just going to be around this. It's the wood, the clay, the pots, you know, and that's pretty much, I can narrow my thoughts down to that.
And the unloading process after a firing. I mean, I quite often go and witness my partner unloading the kiln, and the mixed emotions and the awe, and how do you sit with that?
Post-firing depression is quite a hard thing to get over.
Right.
When you're making the work, well, for me, when I'm making the work and processing the work, I know where in the kiln I want it to go. I know where it's going. I know how I predict it's going to look. I expect certain things to be happening. And, yeah, 9 times out of 10, they don't happen.
Right.
So when you do get that piece out that has completely worked through the whole process, it's like, you know, Christmas.
Yeah.
And then other times you've got to stop and look at those pieces that didn't work and go, but it's still beautiful.
Mm.
Or you go, nah, I'm going to refire it.
Mm.
So I've fired some pots 3, 4, 5 times.
Wow, okay.
To get the right effect that and the right colouring that I want. And each time that's another layer of ash and compounds and clay and maybe glaze over top of it. So,
yeah,
it's a very fluid way of thinking. But, Yeah, post-firing depression is something you have to get used to.
And is it more to do with the disappointment that something hasn't come out the way it is, or the anticlimax from building up, or a combination?
I mean, I've just altered one of my new kilns, or created a new kiln, and I rushed one of the alterations.
Right.
And we did firing for 2 days and got to 900 degrees. Complete failure.
Mm.
You know, week's work gone.
Mm.
You know, the building, the altering, the everything. Went away on holiday, came back, and have completely rebuilt it.
Right.
And it's going like a rocket now. So, doing another firing this week, hopefully.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'd love to watch one, actually. Your work is often described as quite sort of raw and emotional, and sort of pushing the boundaries of the medium and the material, and sometimes to the point of destruction. Could you walk us through how a new piece might sort of come to life, and what you aim to communicate with those things?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because when I was first introducing my work as a potter rather than a student, someone that I've really, really well respected called my work violent.
Okay.
And it shocked me.
Right.
Quite majorly, I was like, what? And I went back about a year later to and saw her and went, you know what? My work's not violent. It's male.
Yeah.
I come off a farm. You know, I'm a country boy. I love trucks and sheds and train saws and, you know, that sort of thing, you know. And with my dyslexia and my ADH, this is how I express myself. You know, and yeah, I take risks. I go the extra mile. I chase the craziness.
Mm.
And now it's just who I am.
I can certainly relate to the dyslexia and the ADHD thing.
Yeah.
And wanting to just keep things raw and alive, and not that sort of overwork
it's
stuff.
Like, how can we make this better?
Mm.
You know, I'm always trying to find a new way to do something, or a new slip, or a new technique. That's why I've rebuilt my kiln again, to get newer work, fresher work, you know.
That's awesome. And you quite often, from what I've seen, you incorporate quite unconventional things in both the surfaces and in the glazes, like scallop shelves and your own hip.
Yeah.
That's like, that's quite extreme.
Well, the scallop shells I use a lot for keeping work apart.
Okay.
So the shell itself will calcify to pure powder.
Right.
And then you have like your piece of work, a shell, piece of clay, another shell, and another piece of work.
Right.
And they all come out with two little fossils of the shell and that has reacted as salt in the shell, and that reacting with the clay forms a little fossil of the shell. So that's used as a compound to stop them sticking.
Yeah.
My hip, that was another complete.
There's something really sort of alchemical and almost like Joseph Boyce-ish about
that. Burning your own and firing your own body.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a hip operation and I asked my hip back, and apparently I was the first person ever to ask.
It's always an artist, isn't it?
And then I told the surgeon that I was going to use it in a glaze, and he was even more horrified. But yeah, I'd actually come up with the title for that 100th show, which was In a Piece.
Yeah.
I'd come up with that title like a year before. Because you know how I said it was a 3-year process. I came up with that title right at the beginning. And it was originally about my inner peace when I'm on the wheel and throwing and creating. But then when I had an inner peace of me, I put it in my oven, roasted it.
Oh, really?
Wow. To break it down to a certain level. And then hit it with a hammer and crushed it, and then put it in the blender with some water and a bit of glaze, and blended it down to, you know, nothing.
That's fascinating.
And then put it on a couple of pieces of work.
Yeah.
That now my girls have. So if I ever, one day when I leave, they've still got a bit of me.
Yeah. And are you tempted to do any more kind of unusual glaze mixtures and stuff?
Yes, but I also do that for other people, where I will get like a matchbox or more of someone's ashes.
Oh, beautiful.
And I will make a series of sculptures and then put that glaze on for them. So instead of having a box of ashes on the shelf, you know, mum, granddad, yeah, whoever is on that piece, and it looks like a piece of artwork, and you can tap it whenever you want and talk to the past, but no one else knows.
Yeah.
So it's actually a really beautiful way. I've done my mum, my dad, and a few friends so far.
That's some voodoo there. That's really beautiful. Well,
people either think it's sick, or people think it's amazing.
Yeah. I think it comes down to your own relationship with bodies and that kind of stuff, and mortality. You could make the urns for people's ashes, not just the urn, but anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the whole journey down that trip.
Yeah, because like we will often save ashes from festivals and stuff, and Liz will work them into glazes for her own things, because different woods and different...
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah. Every wood creates a different ash and has different chemical breakdown. So some woods have got more iron in them, some have got more silica in them, and they all create different colours in the kiln as well. So what wood I use is really, really important.
Definitely. And what sort of colours does a hip produce, for example?
Human ashes can go from like a plain bluey grey.
Right.
To having red spots in it.
Oh, wow.
And then if you add in glazes with it, I can make it go blue or brown, whatever colour. But yeah, just naturally with a clear, and it just depends on where in the kiln it is as well, so how hot it gets.
Yeah.
So when I did the first few, I put them in right through the kiln in different places to see how it reacted. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I can imagine.
To compare the front to the back and go, well, that's changed this much.
Because of the different heats and how it hits things. Because you don't just do pottery, though, do you? You do other types of sculpture that are often exhibited around New Zealand, is that right?
Yeah. I've done quite a few. Well, Nelson Airport, I used to call it mine, because I did all the fences and I did all the people as you walked in and out.
Right.
And I did the barrier-breaking things to stop people smashing into the tiles. And, sadly, when they moved, they got rid of all the sculptures.
Got rid of them, or
Nelson Airport Company gave them all to Nelson and Tasman District Councils,
right?
And said that their building was art on its own, and they didn't want any other art in it.
Oh wow, well, that's an interesting approach.
Yeah, I made all those big stainless steel fences, which half of it is now down at the port in Nelson. And hopefully, possibly, the people will be going up soon.
Right.
Can't say much more about that.
Okay.
But yeah.
And do you take the same sort of rawness of approach with your non-ceramic pieces that you do?
To a certain degree, yes. Yeah. It's also more commission work, where you're working with the client. And therefore, you've got to work out what they want to what, you want. I've had clients who have fully trusted me and loved what they've got. Mm. I've never had an absolute complaint. It's a tricky business doing commissions.
Yeah.
People are giving you money, maybe 2 years and before they see the work.
Wow.
You send them progress photos and stuff.
Yeah.
So they do know that you're creating. But probably a lot of that stuff's not going to happen much more due to the, body slowly failing.
Well, if you keep firing bits of it, you're going to soon run out of stuff as well, aren't you? This is fair enough.
No, true. Shoulder next.
It's quite a physical thing you do, so I suppose it's going to take its toll eventually. I've got a note here to tell us about John Gow. Is that right?
Yeah, he was down at one of the sculpture festivals when we used to have the sculpture festivals in Nelson, and I'd made this really beautiful piece, and a local businessman, let's say, was trying to knock me down in price.
Right.
And I said, no, it's $6,000. He went, no. And at the auction, it went for just over $6,000. And I saw the guy that was trying to outbid, who tried to knock me down. And I went, oh, well, congratulations, you brought it. And he went, no, the guy behind me brought it. And it was John Gow. And he said, nah, there's no way I was going to let that prick have it.
Oh, wow.
And he brought it. So I had to go up to Waiheke and install it. And he's just got an amazing setup there. Beautiful place. Beautiful. Just quietly... It's stunning.
It's a special place, Waiheke. I lived there for a while. It's
It's like way overpriced now.
Yeah.
And unless you were there from the beginning, and it used to be like where all the marijuana for Auckland was growing. And then all those hippies moved to Great Barrier.
Yep.
And now even Great Barrier's getting way too expensive.
Yeah. It's a shame because it's such a beautiful community, like creative community. I really enjoyed my time there.
Yeah.
Which sort of it's interconnects to this next question, which is about in a world of increasingly dominated mass-produced items, how do you sell or communicate the inherent value of handmade? And
It comes down to it being a one-off, an original. It's not. I can't even make two coffee cups look the same. It's just impossible for me. There's people who can. People who can make one every 60 seconds, and I've watched them, throwing a cup. Even though that one thing he did in 60 seconds was one of sort of probably 26 times or something that you touched that piece of clay during the process of making it. I just can't do that. My brain gets bored. I usually make 10 of something and then choose one I like the most and then make another 10 of that one and then choose the best one of that one and make another 10 and then go, oh, I'm going down the wrong direction. I'll go back and choose this one. If I ever do that, which I don't do that often anymore.
So has your work sort of evolved much in the last 30 years, or is it just that natural progression of getting bored and doing something else? Or
I think there's a natural progression.
Yeah.
I think there's a natural knowledge that's been gained through, when I started, I built my first kiln and there was, virtually no documentaries and, a few books. Where now... you can go on Google anything and learn how to throw without even a tutor. And I'm sort of from the old schools. Me and probably both of us are from the last generation that grew up without a computer.
Yeah.
I wonder how much
sort of learning through YouTube and stuff actually affects people's work rather than learning with somebody breathing over your shoulder and sort of mentoring and coaching you.
It's quicker and better because these people are trained teachers usually.
Yeah.
But there's nothing like walking up beside someone and watching their hands and going, oh, he's got his finger like that.
Yeah.
Going back to your own wheel and trying that and going, huh, it's about touch, it's about feel.
Because we recently spoke to Jamie Smith from Kiln and about the environment they've made. You've got all those people working together and learning off each other and building that up. And I think that's quite a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah.
And I think,
there's a little bit of a risk of the beige brigade there, paint by numbers.
Yeah.
But that's part of teaching, and I always say to everyone, this is my style, this is my way. You can be influenced by it, but don't copy.
Yeah.
If you can take what I'm showing you and you use it in your work in a way that makes your work better, that's great. But I don't want you to see, you know, 50 different Daryl Frost lookalikes.
No. I mean, your work is very distinct.
True,
yeah,
true.
This, which is good. And what advice would you give people who are coming into the ceramics at the moment? Like, how would you look back and go, like, what do I wish I knew?
I wish I knew more about marketing.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known more about, you know, using a computer properly. And yeah, I mean, 80% of all artwork is selling your name.
Mm.
It's got nothing to do with what you make.
Yeah.
Luckily, I was in that 20% where I was just making, and I've had people around me who have helped me market it. I mean, my marketing manager, which is me, is not that good, but yeah, luckily I've had artists and galleries and everyone around me who have helped me get where I've got to now. I'd probably be a lot richer if I'd, you know, made a lot more domestic wear.
Yeah.
But I chose right at the beginning to go back to building rather than being a domestic potter.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I created the what we call the sinkers now, my flax plats with the corrows at the bottom, which is I call now my domestic wear, even though everyone's handmade and individual and fired individually and, you know, beautiful. Yeah, that's kept me alive for the last 20, 30 years. So I've still got that one marketing piece of Kiwiana that just keeps ticking over for tourists and stuff.
And you've been in the area, the Tasman area, for quite some time. How do you think things like the Tasman Arts Council or Motueka Arts Council, how can they better support artists in the region, do you think?
I think sometimes they forget that some of us, probably a lot of us, are computer illiterate. All my applications for funding and stuff, I need help with. And it hasn't seemed the safest place to go to, possibly, or I haven't thought, you know, to go there. Because they're too busy. I mean, maybe they could run a workshop where they say, hey, we're going to do this for the week. If you want to apply for anything, you can come in and talk to us about it and we can help you.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because it is that funding.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I got funding for my 100th show through Creative New Zealand. And literally the money itself, well, getting the grant was as important as getting the money.
Yeah.
As a status thing for people to acknowledge that I'm good enough to get that grant.
Wonderful.
Where other people can get grants and they've just verbally diarrhea'd it.
Yeah.
You know?
And lastly, before we go, where can people find your work?
I'm on Harley Road, in Tasman, just off the main road.
Yep.
Yeah. And my website will hopefully get better one day.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for your time, Daryl.
Yeah, not a worry.
Awesome. Cheers,
not a worry,
mate.
At all.
Thanks. Thank you for lending us your ears. You can find more interviews and how to request a Hearth Tale featuring your favourite New Zealand artist, maker or creative soul on our website, hearthtales.com. And you can listen to this episode of Hearth Tales on freshfm.co.nz with a new show every fortnight. Until next time, fare thee well, friends. Fare thee well.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.